I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy, hoy, everybody. Welcome to yet another Talking Simpsons interview episode. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today.
Henry Gilbert and I talk all good and stuff.
So do I. And we're checking all the showrunners off the list, the Simpsons showrunners. Now we're down to what? Just Merkin?
And Al Jean.
And Al Jean. Okay, those are our dual Moby Dicks, yeah. Our dual white whales. But we're not talking about The Simpsons on today's interview. We are talking to Josh Weinstein, who, in case you don't remember, he started with his writing partner Bill Oakley on season 4 of The Simpsons. And with Bill Oakley, he ran season 7 and 8. And now he is the showrunner of the new Netflix series Disenchantment, obviously created by Matt Groening. And Matt and Josh developed it.
Yeah, he is the co-writer of the pilot and, you know, was working with Groening on it from as early as they could, and it's really just a great it's a great show. You've heard our reviews of it.
Yes.
And our What a Cartoon of it too. And Bob and me had a ton of questions just about Disenchantment. Like, we get to totally talk Josh's ear off about Simpsons episodes he worked on and his perspective on those.
I will say, if you're here for Simpsons stuff, it comes up maybe a few times. This is really a Disenchantment-focused interview, but Josh is great to talk to. He's hilarious. So many great stories. And learning about the production of the show was fascinating for me, just how the show is different than a broadcast or cable show.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, if you still haven't watched the entire season of it, we do get into spoilers. We talk about specifics on the final episode,
yeah,
and big revelations that happen in the show. So, I mean, get to watching Disenchantment.
It's been a month. Come on, people.
If you are a human being who watches things, you probably have a Netflix subscription. So just, you know, get to watch.
Check it out. But now check out our interview with Josh Weinstein. So, Disenchantment, your newest series, premiered last month on Netflix, and we're curious, how did that come together? How did you join Matt Groening to work on this project, and how long has it been in the works for?
Yeah, it's been in the works in, like, Matt's head for, like, 10 years, and then we've actually been physically working on it for, like, 3 years, and so Matt had this idea a long time ago. And what he does with his ideas, which is really interesting, is he has these sketchbooks that are both full of, like, list of ideas and characters, but also sketches and drawings of characters he'd like to see. And he has these sketchbooks for all these different ideas. And this one for Disenchantment has, like, really been percolating in his head for a long time. And then about 3 years ago, I had just been finishing up with Gravity Falls, so the time was kind of right, and he said, hey, I have this idea, would you be interested in working on it? And he showed me stuff from his sketchbooks, and he told me all his grand ideas, and I was like, I have to do this, because it's awesome, and it, like, rings all my bells. And so then we started working on it, and then we actually had, like, a year to sort of develop it and flesh it out before we even began production or brought other writers on. And then once we brought other writers on and people like Bill and stuff who had brilliant observations, then we reshaped and formulated the show from that point on.
How much of the show did Matt figure out on his own before, you know, collaborating? I'm just curious because a lot of it, especially visually, looks very Matt Groening-y, even without the animator cleanup you get with some Simpsons characters. Characters like Lucy and the King definitely look like straight out of a Life in Hell comic.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people say, and I think it's kind of true. It's like there's new school Matt Groening stuff with the kind of like the backgrounds we do, but it's really old school with characters like Lucy, yeah, and Zog. And I think it's just a different type of characters that were in Matt's head. And for example, he knew he had already come up with Zog and Elfo, and there was a princess, but she wasn't quite Bean yet. And well, then there were a couple, and he had some of the side characters as well. And he also had characters that have yet to even appear.
Yeah.
So I'd say, like, he had a very good general idea about the show. And then I came in and kind of helped flesh it out. And that's also when we decided that we really wanted to make it, because of the way Netflix shows are released, make it serialized and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was really curious how different it was going from linear stories. You know, you mentioned working on Gravity Falls, and that does have a more kind of linear story. But before that, like, Mission Hill and The Simpsons, and also Sit Down, Shut Up. Like, those are more sitcom-style episodic stories. What was it like to go into a more linear story like that?
I think, like, for us, like, it's really exciting, because I think after, like, I've been doing this for 25 years, and while it's fun, like, on a show, like, especially like Futurama or The Simpsons or Gravity Falls, to tell a freestanding story, to tell these deep-running arcs that could go for years, if we're so lucky, that's kind of really exciting. So it was exciting to us, but it's also, yeah, it's kind of a new thing. I learned a lot from people like Alex Hirsch on Gravity Falls, and I think that we're still, like, over the first season, we're kind of, like, we were also learning how to do it right.
Like, what's it like to have a show where you have, you know, long-standing secrets to keep? Did maybe working on the secrets of Who Shot Mr. Burns kind of help you with that?
Yeah, you know what? It did. It did. And we actually talked about, like, how that's, like, that's the one thing that we worked on before that, and also, like, Gravity Falls, but had to keep big secrets for a long time. And as a matter, here's a side anecdote is we were so paranoid about anything getting out about all the secrets and arcs that for when we have table reads, we actually made fake script covers that look like operation manuals for like dishwashers and stuff. So if anybody left their script lying out, like no one would pick it up because who's going to want to read, you know, how to operate a dishwasher. So we actually would spend like hours coming up with funny fake covers for the scripts, but that was just because we were so paranoid about secrets. And there's still like people have discovered some of the secrets, but they haven't discovered all of them.
Yeah, you guys did a great job. I was expecting at least one drawing to leak or one design to get out there, but it was pretty much nothing until the official announcement. So that was
yeah,
amazing.
there was super like and like pretty heavy duty like scary legal warnings and stuff to us, like do not let this out. Do this drawing, cannot leave this building. And we have these big super high security garbage pails in our office.
Whoa.
that are locked, and like so only the shredding company can open them. And so anytime like we're done with a design or whatever, they go in there.
Wow.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Locked garbage cans. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of like, it's both kind of exciting and kind of pathetic.
I mean, you know, the part of the fun is the surprise. So these days, like, on Who Shot Mr. Burns, I know Merkin joked that he tried to leak the fake endings to people and people weren't picking it up. I would think now those would have spread the second someone tried to contact person to leak the fake endings.
Oh my God, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So that was a good dry run for this.
So I heard Matt Groening in an interview talk about working with Netflix executives, and it was one of the few times I heard executives spoken of in a positive light. And I'm just curious, what has your experience been with the execs at Netflix compared to working at Fox? Simpsons was infamously a note-free show.
Oh my God, I have to say it's a beautiful experience because even though like the executives at Fox were not allowed to interfere with the Simpsons, and they weren't supposed to a Futurama, but they tried. Like for Futurama, and I wasn't there in the beginning, but as I understand it, it's like the top executives there did not get the show and they did not like it, and that's why they screwed with it and kept rescheduling it, even though like Matt's made billions of dollars for Fox. It was not always like a friendly reception, and the executives also weren't it's surprising how many comedy executives aren't that funny or don't have good senses of humor. But with Netflix, it's like it's the total opposite.
Wow.
It's not only do we have great senses of humor, they're like really nurturing. So when I'm sure you've read, like they're really famous, and it's true, for letting creators sort of go with the show. They hire people they trust and they say go with it. And then whenever they have had notes, they're always like really well thought out, and we're like, yeah, you know what? That is a good idea. We'll do that. And so they're just, it's such a different experience than I've had in the last 25 years.
Wow, that's great to hear.
Yeah, I saw Alex Hirsch tweet out that he just signed a deal with Netflix as well, and just how creator forward, I think was the phrase he used for Netflix.
Yeah, that makes sense. And they have really, especially in the world of animation, they've got some really great people there. That's also what I like. It's like they have really great comedy executives and also people who were brought up in the world of animation and comedy. So they're actually doing something they love, which I guess is not always true for every executive.
You would help. Yeah. So how did you assemble the team, but starting with the writing staff, how was building this team, similar difference to when you were showrunner on Simpsons or Mission Hill?
That's a good question, because it was kind of both the same and different. Because when Bill and I took over the Simpsons, and the same with Mission Hill, it was like there are a few friends who are writers who we know we just have to have because they're brilliant. But then we always thought you've got to shake up the mix, and you don't just want the same old farts. And we also always maintain, and the same on this show, is that we want to hire people who we've never worked with and that we don't even know. And so part of the process is there's a few people I knew I had to have on the show, like Bill and David Cohen and also Pat Verhoeven and Eric Horsted from Futurama. But aside from that, then I was like, you know what? We're old farts. I think all those guys are hilarious, but we need some young people as well. And so, actually funny, brilliant people as well. So I hired a couple of people, writers that I love from Gravity Falls, Jeff Rowe and Shion Takeuchi, who are both brilliant. And then also I found a team of writers, Jenny Batten and M. Dixon, who I had never met before, but I just read their spec scripts and I thought they were some of the funniest specs I've ever read. So we hired them. But then we hired, for example, Rich Fulcher, who you guys know from Mighty Boosh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah, and from Mighty Boosh and Snuffbox. And then I had done a pilot with Rich and Matt Berry for Fox that never went anywhere, that took 3 years to go nowhere. Aww. And was a miserable experience, but we all kind of got along, and I loved Rich, who's both an actor and a writer, and it ended up that Rich went to the same high school that Bill and I did.
Whoa.
But we didn't know that at first, but he was a couple years older, and I think we would recognize each other, but that was it. But anyway, so I hired Rich, and so we also have actor writers on the show. So I think we tried to have a really good mix.
Rich and Jenny, both, I love hearing their voices in it too. And I think that, does that also make them kind of want to pitch? Do you ever notice them pitching stuff for their characters? Hey, what if my character said this or did this?
Yes, they do. They do. They will. It's luckily they're good. They're so good that they will pitch for other characters all the time. But it's kind of fun because if Rich is pitching a joke in a Turbish joke in a Turbish voice, it's extra fun. So, because most writers, we're all kind of quiet nerds. So it's good to have some more lively people.
So we have a lot of questions about the production of the show because you're not limited by the constraints of broadcast TV or cable TV. And we're just curious about, how do you decide on the length of episodes? And are there deleted scenes? Do they even exist in this format? Do you cut things?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because when we started out, we were like, oh my God, we don't... The only limit is budget. Because obviously every second of animation costs time and money to do. So we have to be considerate of... It's called pencil mileage. And so we have to be really careful about that. But then we felt, because we do have unlimited time, and as a matter of fact, every episode of The Simpsons or Futurama has to be cut down to under 21 minutes, and our minimum is 25 minutes and 30 seconds. So already that gives us so much more room to tell story. And also what we thought is we would like this show to breathe. Because in The Simpsons or Futurama, you end up cutting a scene that's say it's just Homer driving along. And like in our show, like if we have the characters walking through the Enchanted Forest, we would normally have to cut it. But if it's a really beautiful shot and gives a good feel to it, now we can keep it in. But I have to say, I think we learned after the reaction from this first batch, and of course we love these episodes, but some people said, oh, it felt kind of draggy. Hmm. And whereas we would say like, oh, we think it's like to let the show breathe. I think we are more mindful of that, where I think for the second batch, we're probably going to edit them down tighter, but still allow room to breathe.
Oh yeah. Well, that led me to the next question. Actually, what was, you know, with The Simpsons or the other shows on broadcast TV, week to week, you're producing and you get a reaction week to week. But here with Netflix, you put your whole season out and people react to the whole season at once.
Yeah.
So it must be pretty different to react to that as opposed to a weekly show going up.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy because, you know, you spend 2 or 3 years making these episodes and you have our staff and the animators and everyone on the show and Netflix watching these episodes. So we get feedback that we trust and love, but then it's still like the public hasn't seen it. And we're going, here's the whole thing. Here's the whole season, love it or not. And so it's very, to be honest, it's nerve wracking. And especially like when the first reviews came out and they were mixed, and some people loved the show, but some people hated it. And I'm like, oh my God. And it's like, I'm the type of person that they say like, don't read the reviews, but I read every single one. And so anytime you read a bad review, it makes you feel really bad. Mm. And so you have to also kind of learn to trust what you take from reviews, because some criticism is valid and some we feel isn't. And so then the reviews came out and then we're like, let's see what the fans think. And then it was a huge relief when it actually came out to see like from the fans, it was almost overwhelmingly positive. And we're like, okay, we are doing something that not just we like. But then we also, I think we are mindful of like, we're looking at what the fans really love, and we do want to write for them. You know what I'm saying? Well, before we're just, and as we did like in The Simpsons in the 90s, before the internet really took off, we were really writing for ourselves and what made ourselves laugh and what we liked. And we kind of do that on every show. But now with the internet, and especially things like Twitter and stuff where we can see what fans like and don't like, that we do kind of listen.
You sound like you're pretty plugged into the critical reception of the show online. Have any responses surprised you in any way?
Of course, I love any ones that are super positive. And then I feel like, yeah, they get the show. They get what we're doing. But some of the bad ones made me go, huh? because I have a theory about it too, but in some of the bad ones, they're like, the colors are all washed out and the animation is terrible. And I'm like, that's just played wrong. Mm. Like, you can say, I don't like a character or I don't like the jokes, but there's some things that were just wrong. So that made me go, huh. But I think some people, critics especially, went into it with a construct in their head. Like, I want to see Futurama Part 2. And if you do that, I think then you're going to be taken aback because it's not the same pacing, it's not the same world, and it's not totally the same type of storytelling. So I think those people might have gotten, like, they got taken out of it or whatever, because they were expecting something so strongly in their head, and it wasn't that. But I think if you go into it just going like, I want to see the new Matt Groening show with Matt Groening-style characters and writers and animators, then I think you can really enjoy the ride.
Was it interesting too to see like before release when there were just trailers out, or even before the trailers, just like the first images of it, and seeing what people guessed characters were going to be like when they first see like Bean, Lucy, and Elfo?
Yeah, that was really fun, because it's like, what's really fun is when people get it like right away. And there were a number of people who sort of surmised what those characters would be like. And so that was sort of fun. Mm-hmm. And it's also fun now to see people's theories, about what's going to happen. And some people's theories are correct and some aren't. And there's certain things that nobody's gotten yet.
Watching it myself, one thing it really did remind me of classic like Simpsons or Futurama was how like dense a lot of it was, but in surprising ways, when I'd go back and rewatch some of the episodes, I'd be like, oh, that's a tease for that later thing. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, exactly. That's one thing that Matt and I have been saying from the very beginning is this show will reward you if you watch it multiple times. So it's really heartening. Like I see on Twitter, it's like people are saying, because like they're waiting for the next season to come. They're like, I've already watched this show 5 times. And if you do that, you will notice more things.
Wow.
Because from the very first episode, certain secrets are laid in that will pay off both in part two, but also will pay off at the very end of the series and throughout. And there's clues, and some are kind of hidden and some are in plain sight. But you will, because also we know how the series is going to end. And when we reach that point, we hope that viewers will go like, oh my God, that was there from the very first episode.
That's great. One thing I noticed about the storytelling that I really like is that it's very light on parody. You could have easily done just parody with Disenchantment, but you kind of have a lighter touch. Was that an intent from the beginning?
Yes. Thank you for pointing that out, because that was very intentional. Because the thing is, there have been 1,000 great fantasy TV shows, movies, and books, and there have also been 1,000 great parodies of fantasy, and starting with like even before Monty Python, but with like Monty Python, and there's also like there have been 1,000,000 parodies of Game of Thrones, and if we kind of did a slavish parody show, I think it would just feel old and stupid, and we wanted, and it's also because like we like Futurama, and hopefully it comes across in here is like we kind of love fantasy worlds and fantasy stories, and so it's both done with a love for it, but also like a great desire to make fun of it. But we want to tell our own stories and stuff. So if there happens to be a parody that hasn't been done, we might do it, but we really don't.
The sense of humor I noticed that's really in your wheelhouse and Bill's as well is all of the old-timey jokes. Like, so much of the humor in Disenchantment was, what if this thing you know existed but had way less technology behind it? Like, the yeah, donkeys that are
totally.
Police cars.
That's one of the reasons I felt I have to do this show. it's set in the past and way in the past, and that's totally my wheelhouse. So, like, we get to do a whole new type of an even older type of old-timey in this show, which I love.
I also, something I love about Dreamland just as a setting is that it's called Dreamland, and just the more you get to know it, like the worse it is. Like it's such a horrible place.
That's what Dreamland is. One thing that Matt had from the very beginning too. It's like, that's like, it's called Dreamland, but it's really this crumble down place. But there's a canonical reason that this has not been revealed yet. It's like, there's a canonical reason Dreamland is like that.
Interesting. And wow. I figured it was because Zog is terrible as a ruler.
Yeah, Zog is a bad ruler, and Dreamland has gone downhill under his rule. However, that's not the barking point for Dreamland's downhill run. That's all I can say.
People aren't paying the bridge tax. That's the problem.
Yeah, nobody pays the bridge tax. That's the big secret of the show.
Oh my God.
About tax.
We'll edit this out, don't worry.
The finger thing means
no,
the tax.
But there's a part of a show, and also what we've seen from fans too, is that they really like when we go out and further explore the world around Dreamland and go to different places, which we do have a lot in part two. It's like, it still comes back to Dreamland, and the show will ultimately finish in Dreamland as well.
Interesting.
Well, so the cast, we've talked a little about them, but yeah, the cast is so great, and not, it's full of like, people who were amazing on Futurama, but also there's, in the leads, it's some newer voices, at least into the graining cast of characters. Was that the intent, to get some fresher faces in there?
Yes, it's sort of like the writing staff. It's like we on Futurama, I think even more so than The Simpsons, that Futurama was like a family. And it's like, and I wasn't there on every season, but when I was there and when Bill and I were there, it always felt like everybody just got along so well, the actors and the animators and the writers and everyone. And so it's a big family. And so every time Futurama got canceled, which is many times, everyone is like, oh, we got to do this again. So like Matt and I knew that we had to get the Futurama gang back for this. And by the way, we ultimately aim to have the entire Futurama cast on. I don't know about people notice also the character of Mop Girl is played by Lauren Tom.
Oh, wow.
Because she doesn't say anything for a long time. But we want everyone from Futurama back on the show, but then we also wanted to mix it up. And then for the three leads, we got really lucky that we got these brilliant actors. And the interesting thing about the leads, with Abby and Eric and Nat, is there are all three of them are also all writers and directors themselves. So like they bring like this extra level of comedy and joke telling ability that is really great. And just as we did with Futurama, it's like we really let the actors ad lib. We record every scene as written like two or three times, and then we go to the actors like, go ahead and make it your own and just say what comes to your head. And sometimes it's stuff that we could have never come up with. So I feel like we lucked out with Abby, Eric, and Nat. And then also myself being a huge fan of British comedy and having worked with Matt Berry and being obsessed with the Mighty Boosh, I was like, we got to get Matt Berry on the show. We got to get Noel Fielding on the show. And then through Rich, he introduced us to this actor comedian Lucy Montgomery, who's kind of our British Tress McNeil, who does like Bunty and all the different British side voices. So I apologize for blabbing. But one other secret that we had is like we couldn't reveal that Dagmar comes alive. So we couldn't reveal that Sharon Horgan, who's an amazing actress and comedian, does the voice of Dagmar. Mm. So that's something that we had to keep secret till the show came out.
First I was shocked when I felt the Dagmar stuff. I was like, oh, they're probably waiting until season two. And then, boom, she's there at the end. And then when I saw in the credits, the actress, I was like, oh, that's amazing. That's great.
Yeah,
one, cool. Matt Berry especially was such a treat to hear just in the first episode. Like his voice is one of my favorite just voices. And also on Garth Marenghi's Dark Place, he is so good at that.
Oh my God. That's anybody out there who has not seen Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. I think you can get it on DVD, which is how I saw it. It's one of the funniest things ever.
So good.
Yeah. And it's like you can see a lot of the great modern British comedians is like in that. That's brilliant. I love Matt Berry, and it's like he seems to be a breakthrough character, and people really like it and feel for Murkimer.
So I want to know about the writing process of Disenchantment. Does it use a similar pipeline to former shows you've worked on, and how does it work with people like, I know Bill Skypes in or he video chats in. How does that change the dynamic?
It's with modern technology, it's pretty seamless. Like that Bill will, when we're writing or rewriting, like Bill will come down here, and like when we had table reads or had like intensive story pitch outs, Bill would be down here in person. But otherwise, he'll Skype in, and the technology is so good. It's really just like having him in a room. And so we have the screen. When he first started out, we just had a computer, and we put a computer screen at the other end of a table and put it up on a little stand. So Bill's head would be the proper height as if he were sitting at a table. So you start to forget that he's all the way in Portland, and it feels like he's actually there. Now in our new office, we have a giant screen, so Bill's head is about 10 feet wide. So it's more like talking to Oz. But but yeah, it's with technology, people can really kind of like, you can literally Skype into the rewrite room and it works.
I was going to ask, are you worried that you're going to lose Bill to the internet food reviewing industry? He's becoming very popular these days.
I love, oh my God, those reviews are some of the funniest things ever. So I think it's like, it's, Bill and I are both used to doing like multiple things. So hopefully he becomes, I think they should do a show. I think the Food Network would be wise to hire him to do a show with these mini reviews. But I don't think we'll lose him. But I really hope those keep catching on.
That's how I know he's down in L.A. to work on stuff. I'm like, oh, he's eating in a place in L.A. this week instead of in Portland.
Yes. There's like, if you can do detective work and figure out where Bill is at the time. And for example, we have a writer from Australia, Adam Briggs, who also he wrote an episode in the upcoming second batch. But he comes in and out of L.A. So when he was in L.A., he and Bill plan their review to go to Outback Steakhouse together.
Yeah, that was a good one. What are the lunches like at Disenchantment 2? Is it Bill approved?
Is there a bell?
Oh my God. That's, you know what? Bill has not done reviews of our lunches, and they would be, it's like, well, everybody got salads again. everybody got the salmon. It's really boring.
Well, you mentioned all the improvisation. I think one of my favorites was when Nat is Elfo. At least it sounded like improvisation. Elfo talking about his father spanking him on the bum bum.
Oh my God! Yes, yes. That just came. That came out of Nat's head. Like that was what a thing where he said, like, okay, we've got this scene as is. You guys. And because like the delightful thing is it's not, we don't always have all the actors together, but when we do, it's awesome. And they're all standing around their microphones on the soundstage and they just started ad-libbing. And this came out of Nat's mouth about Daddy Elfo smacking him on the bum bum. and the real reaction, there's this real awkward pause that we kept to the final episode of, and people are just like, what the hell?
That really sells it. I love
so,
it.
And so, but like, that's the thing that you could never, I don't think we could ever write, but it's so good because it's real. It's really real. It's, those things are coming out of their heads at that moment. And we captured it on tape or on digital, whatever.
Yeah. Actually on that same episode, there is a kind of a drug fueled rant by Bean. And we talked to you on Twitter. You said a lot of that, or some of it at least, came out of Abby's improvisation.
Oh, right. Now that's an interesting thing. Cause there's different things like the Daddy Elfo spec beyond the bum bum and that whole Bad Elfo. And I'd rather hang out with Bad Elfo. Mm-hmm. That's entirely ad lib.
Wow.
Now the drug run is a combination of brilliant room writing with Abby's ad libs, because that drug run, every single writer in the room contributed at least one line to that. It was like something, it was one of those things, kind of like, I will not claim it's like as good as like the Dr. Zaius musical, because nothing is, but that was the case, Dr. Zaius, where everybody in the room just loved the idea so much, everyone jumped into hilarious jokes, and we wrote it in like half an hour. Or a couple hours, probably. And the same with a drug run is like people love the idea so much that everyone contributed a line. But then when he brought it to Abby, she added like at least two more brilliant lines.
Especially with the younger, you know, people on staff. Have you heard from them? They're like, oh, I was such a big Simpsons fan, or this is amazing working with you guys. Like, do you get a lot of that?
Yes, it's cool. And I got to say, getting love is really nice because when we were doing The Simpsons in the 90s, like there was, and I think you've probably heard these stories, like the internet was still in its like kind of nascent stages. And like Bill's a real computer whiz. He's a whiz with the computers. And so we, in like season 4 and 5, we got modem Ethernet service put into our office. So we actually had to dial up to get to Alt TV Simpsons, only to find people saying worst episode ever. And that was like the fourth season, like the greatest season of TV ever made. And even then people were going, worst episode ever. The Simpsons is going downhill. And I think that was both, it was really disheartening to have to spend 15 minutes dialing in to hear that people hated what you were doing and that you loved. Oh, wow. But so at that time in the 90s, we were really like, we weren't really in touch with fans, and we were really writing for ourselves. So what's really cool is now there are people like you guys who I'm presuming grew up watching The Simpsons. And I know of people like on Gravity Falls and Alex Hirsch, they grew up, that was their show when they were kids watching it. So it's really cool to see like our kids grown up, because in the 90s we were just writing, I sound like such an old fart, but we were just writing what we liked and made us laugh, and a lot of adults in the outside world did not share our sense of humor. So it's kind of cool that we could influence people who are just kids then with their sense of humor, just kind of like Mad Magazine and like SCTV and National Lampoon did to us. It's cool to meet writers who grew up influenced by stuff we wrote. And then what's cool about them is they take everything even further. Like, they're farther evolved than us. Because, like, I grew up on crappy cartoons like Scooby-Doo. They grew up on The Simpsons. So they're already smarter. They're smarter and funnier than we are. And they're also, like, they are more able to embrace things like emotion and not crap on emotion and to treat it realistically. And so I feel like the younger writers, and also people like Eric Andre and Abby Jacobson, also grew up watching The Simpsons. And so I feel like they're further evolved than we are.
Yeah, Eric Andre is like, he's famous for such like a wild personality on his titular show. And then you've got Abby, like, she's so great on Broad City and has done such amazing things. Like, To know that you inspired people like that, that's got to be heartening.
It's really, it's really cool. And then it's kind of a good feedback loop, because then they inspire us. And like, we learn to like write to like what Abby's strengths are and what Eric's strengths are and that sort of thing. So it kind of feeds on itself in a good way.
So in terms of the content, the rules for Netflix are very different, too. The show has drinking and drugs and quite a few goddamn it sprinkled in, which kind of surprised me. Going into this, did you decide, like, what is the worst thing that can be said on this show? What is the most extreme we'll go on this show? Because I take it you can pretty much kind of do anything on Netflix, or did Netflix have rules for you concerning that as well?
There were no rules. And no censorship. So it was up to us. And as a matter of fact, in the very first draft of the pilot, characters say shit. And we were like, oh, you know what? It just feels gratuitous and it doesn't feel right. And I think we just kind of felt like we can be a bit more adult and stuff, like have drug references and some sex references and stuff, but it doesn't, being crude or crass doesn't feel right in the Matt Groening universe, and we sort of don't like it. So it's really more, it's just us censoring ourselves.
Yeah, I guess after 30 years, it would be odd to see a Matt Groening character say a real, quote unquote, real curse word.
An R-rated swear.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if Marge said, fuck you, Homer, it would be so, it'd be really unpleasant and upsetting. And there's no real reason to do it. You know, like, let shows that are, like, for example, Rick and Morty can do it because it feels so right and they do it brilliantly and hilariously, but it just doesn't feel right for us.
So I bet, you know, if you want one moment to really land, just have, like, Bean say fuck once, and everybody like, whoa, she said it.
Maybe that will be the final word of the series, and people will be like, oh.
Wow, they saved it for
it
that.
It was all leading up to this.
Yeah. Though, content-wise, too, it's, I really like how violent it can be out of nowhere, like, compared to... Definitely violent things happen on The Simpsons. Violent things happen on Futurama. Yeah. But characters like directly tell Bean, like, you've killed lots of people. And she's like, no.
Yeah. We can like that. And there are, like, believe it or not, we actually have rules about violence, which is that if there's violence, it's at least it has to be funny or clever. Like, you can't. And I'm sure we have instances where it just feels gratuitous, but they are thought out. And we are like, we don't, nothing should be gratuitous. So it at least has to be funny or clever. And Ben Bean killing people kind of ended up is something that kind of happened because we knew that she was going to kill Giesbert unintentionally. And then, but then the idea of her unintentionally killing people and sometimes intentionally, it was just fun for us.
Now the trap door at the end of the party where she thinks she just did a fun thing of like, no, I just sent him to water and it's low tide. Mm. That was a great reveal.
Yeah. And in our, boy, I can't say anything.
Okay.
I was going to say something. I can't say anything.
Okay.
So I was just curious, like as big Simpsons nerds, we love the commentaries. We learn so much from them. It's sort of like the real history of the show. Would you want to do Disenchantment commentaries? Is that possible on Netflix? I just want to know, like, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've been thinking about that, and I think it's possible because, you know, how, like, on Netflix, they also show trailers and they'll have behind-the-scenes thing. Mm-hmm. I think what would be really cool, ultimately, is to, and also, you know how, like, it's dubbed in different languages.
Yeah,
right.
For around the world, is I think we could, 2 episodes, add that extra track. And it would just be that you get it off of Netflix.
Yeah,
so I think
totally.
that would be a really cool thing.
Yeah, now the commentaries, like before podcasts really got big, my regular listening would be DVD commentaries, specifically The Simpsons, but then it kind of grew from there.
Yeah, I loved them too. Look, because we were, you know, like that Bill and I were huge Simpsons nerds before we started, so I kind of loved them too. For like episodes I wasn't involved with, I want to hear the behind-the-scenes stuff, too.
Well, so how is the animation team built for Disenchantment? I know like it shares a lot of production people from Futurama, and also like Wes Archer's there, too. Like, so how did that come together?
That was something we knew from the beginning. It's just like we loved Rough Draft so much from Futurama. And the interesting thing is Rough Draft is a company that was founded by animators and is run by animators. And they really go above and beyond. And we said from the beginning, it's like, look, this is like, we have Matt style characters, but we want this to be like a really lush world. And we want the backgrounds to kind of feel like they're from a beautiful storybook. So Rough Draft and all the animators, they're really kind of like stepped up and did a beautiful job. And then people like Wes, we just love. And Wes, I don't know if people know that from the very beginning of The Simpsons, before they even did the shorts and they were just starting, it was Matt Groening and David Silverman and Wes. So he's one of the very original guys, and he's just brilliant and is really great at telling a story, but also being hilarious. And so we bring him in when we can.
I was surprised to see his name in the credits just because I know he's also seems pretty have his hands full on Rick and Morty. So
for the next
really,
yeah. episodes,
when I first saw his name on the director's list, I was like, "What? We got Wes?" So yeah, he's awesome. And there's also some new people who are awesome, and some also what I like about Rough Draft, and it's similar to our writing staff, is people, they promote people up. So I've seen people go from like people who are storyboard people on The Simpsons are now directors, and people like Pete Avanzino, I think, started as a storyboard guy way back on The Simpsons, and now he's one of our supervising directors. So it's cool to see people get promoted up.
Yeah.
So Mark Mothersbaugh does the music for Disenchantment. What kind of theme did you want going in terms of music and in terms of how much music you're using in the show?
Yeah, that was another huge get for us. Because to me, Mark Mothersbaugh is kind of the Matt Groening of music, where he's brilliant, but also hilarious. And we knew it was something also like, because like I said before, there have been so many fantasy TV shows and movies that if we just went with kind of like English medieval plinky plunk music, it would seem hacky and old. And we wanted to do something really new. And we felt both Matt and I really like Eastern European kind of like brass band, Balkan style music. But we wanted to have not just that, but some sort of interesting amalgam. And Mark Mothersbaugh is kind of a genius composer and also a genius at bringing different musical genres and literally different musical instruments in to make a sound. So we kind of approached him and we just said, here's a certain type of music. Here's some pieces that we really like. Create the sound for the show. And then he came back with that theme, which is so catchy. And that theme then helped inspire the music for the rest of the show.
Yeah, the opening is so raucous and fun and catchy. And we told people on our podcast, do not skip it because you'll see new drawings that sort of will set up the episode to follow. And
yeah, exactly.
Also, it's only 20 seconds long.
That's another thing with like hidden secrets is in those credit art cards, there's some stuff that you'll see happens in that episode, but there's sometimes there's cards about stuff that won't even happen till the distant future.
Hmm.
Ooh.
And also what we love is that Mark, and also I should give cred to the guy who works with him, Ray Plaza, who's also a brilliant composer, and they've done many different versions of the themes that pop up, and it also depends on how long the opening credits are.
I had a question about an Easter egg from the last episode that I don't know how much you can say about it, but people caught it, like, well, once they got to it, I paused it too in the rewinding section. It's made to be freeze framed, and people caught that the time machine that can only go forward with Fry, Farnsworth, and Bender in it. So how was that just a cute thing to add in, and how hard was it to get characters from Futurama officially in your show?
We were like, let's make sure that this is totally, because we loved it, but we were like, we got to make sure this is fully legal. And so like, those images are licensed.
Oh.
I know. So it's like, it's all officially, like, we didn't get away with anything in it, but you know what I'm going to say? It's like, I can't really talk about it.
Okay.
But to me, nothing is... If I say anything, I'm going to lead people down the wrong path as well.
Okay.
So I better be careful, but there's canon of the show. There's also stuff, we have like our own head canon too. and that's all I can say.
Okay.
I don't want people to go into part two going, oh my God, I got to find more Futurama Easter eggs. Cause like, that's not it. But I will say that nothing is random unless it is something really good and random.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
All right.
Well, so I'm curious too, how characters like grew as you wrote them, or how, like, you know, and this just happens naturally in a TV show. Like how did, like, say Zog change, or Elfo, or Bean change as you're writing the show?
That's a good question, because like, obviously, like, you start out with these characters and they're like, we thought they're very well fleshed out to begin with, but then once you get the actual actor to do the voice, that starts fleshing it out. And once you see the actors interact, that informs it. And as you write stories and come up with jokes, like one type of joke, for example, that smack me on the bum bum joke, did that, although that was totally ad-libbed and it's random, that type of thing helps flesh out and inspire a character. And the fun thing was, we always knew it centered around the trio of Bean, Elfo, and Lucy. But what was great is when Nat, Abby, and Eric actually got together, and now they've actually become friends. So like in real life, the same thing actually happened. And that's really great, because they really do play off each other like these people who are newly friends.
How much did John DiMaggio add to the character of Zog? I wanted to know if he was always considered sort of the royal Archie Bunker from the beginning, because it sounds like John is also channeling someone he knows.
I'll tell you this one thing on Futurama. I know it like, was my goal, and I think other writers, like, we would intentionally write things just to make John DiMaggio laugh. Because like, we knew, first of all, if he laughed at a joke, we knew it was a good joke, but it's like, you want to make that guy laugh. And he's so funny. And what I love too about our cast is people like Abby and Eric and Nat, like, they've all done some voices on other show, animated shows like BoJack Horseman and stuff, but they've never really done full-time animated voiceover work. So they'll come to our records and they learn from people like John and Maurice and Tress and Billy and Dave Herman. Like, so it's really cool to see they look up to those guys as the experienced veteran voice actors. And so they've taught those guys a lot, but it's like, yeah, John, we just knew had to be the king. But interestingly, originally he was going to do it with this British voice. And we were like, you know what? Try more Archie Bunker gruff guy. And that's also part, you know, of Red from the Tavern tapes.
Oh yeah.
Oh, you're right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Man. It's part like, I'm going to tear off your head and blah, blah, who is also the original influence for Mo in Mo's Ball.
Wow. Yeah.
But, so he's kind of like a combination of, it's also like he's a lot like John DiMaggio, except that John DiMaggio's a sweet guy. But he's like John, he's like Archie Bunker, he's like Red from those tapes. He's a lot of different things, all sorts of different gruff big guys.
Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to, when I see Zog, I'm going to think of him as the Mo Sizlak, but as a king now.
Yeah, it's like, I'll tear up my throat and cram it down your face.
Now, Zog, Zog is one of my favorite characters in the show, and I think he grows so much, like in the first episode.
Yeah.
I thought he was just like, he's just a jerk. Like, he's just the jerk king. But especially by the final episode, you really feel for him. Like, he's had a lot of shit.
Yeah.
And I do
that was all really planned. Because it's like, the thing is, like, people, like, John as an actor has such range. And we just knew, like, we wanted people to see that song. Like, I think we did this well in The Simpsons, if I can honk our own horn. It's like that we always like to show the humanity behind every character. And for example, like Ned Flanders, we start to explore it and see the person behind that character. And the same with Zog, and hopefully all our characters eventually, is we want to show like because like people are like that. Not everyone is just a gruff asshole. And Zog's seen real tragedy and he has real feelings, and it's also what we like is like he's got real feelings towards Bede and he really loves her, and so like that's a complicated relationship as well.
Yeah, I love the line. I think the line that really opened him up for me was when he's like, I forget the first part, but then he says, cruel also maybe.
Like, yeah, that's a David Cohen line. But yeah. Yeah, no, he is, and I think it's also what John brings to it, that you really see the human tragic side to him.
Well, and I guess a last question for me, like, some of my favorite stuff, especially in the first episode, is Elfo's home, like the land of the elves and and especially the names, like who built that, like who, I guess the whole team did, I suppose, but.
Yeah, I think that's what I'll take some credit, because it really started with the speak no more of Levo Spico. that was my joke for the pilot after, and then that was sort of like, well, it really started, obviously it started with Elfo, which comes from Matt. But I think once we got Spico and Levo and Returno, we're like, okay, that's what we're gonna do.
I'm a big Returno fan.
Yeah.
We mentioned Returno and Levo are the two elves who have never come back. There is a chance that we might run into one of them.
Oh boy.
Coming up. And other, there's a deeper, let me just say this, and this is also, this has not been said. There's a deeper story to the elves.
Ooh, than exclusive.
I just want to know why they make candy and pay themselves in candy. It doesn't make sense.
That's a really poorly planned economy.
It really is.
But there's a deeper story there that people will see played out over, hopefully, if we're so lucky to have more seasons.
Well, thanks a lot, Josh, for taking time out of your busy schedule. You're working on season 2. I take it that's still TBD when that drops on Netflix.
Yeah, I think they're gonna hopefully release it as soon as we get it in, but that's still a few months away.
I'm really looking forward to it.
And your Twitter is great. You've especially, since Disenchantment came out, you've been retweeting a ton of cool like fan stuff and like tattoos people have been getting.
I know we have to wrap up. I just say we love the fan art so much. And the fact that people are getting tattoos and like especially a lot of Lucy tattoos is so heartening and delightful to us. And so like we're like every day we actually have we've built a wall. I might tweet that out, but we have a wall of fan art that we love that's constantly growing. So amazing. Yeah, we love getting fan feedback, especially positive stuff, but we listen to the criticisms. And also, so if people want to look at my Twitter is Josh Strange Hill. And also I want to get back to also finding old Simpsons scenes that we cut that I like to tweet out as well.
Those are always fun.
Yeah, I love seeing the old pages on Twitter. They're great. So thanks again to Josh Weinstein for sitting down with us for an hour. And please reach out to him on Twitter at Josh Strange Hill. We always ask our listeners to let people know they enjoyed the interviews, and that way they might come back, or they might tell their famous writer friends that these two nice nerds have a great little show and you should talk to them. So please reach out to at Josh Strange Hill and follow him, because he tweets a lot of great stuff. He often tweets about Simpsons history. Josh is a great guy to follow on Twitter.
Yeah, and you'll see, maybe he'll even have tweeted out that cool picture he was just talking about of all the fan art. Mm-hmm. And just that, and as you heard too, he really listens to the fans, and he likes knowing what they're thinking. So if you're tweeting at him, he's probably reading it. So.
Definitely. So be nice. Yeah, be nice to poor Josh.
Yeah, and let him know how cool we are.
Yes, exactly. And I want to say this is like our 15th interview, 14th interview, 15th, something up there. And we can't do it without patrons like you.
Uh-huh.
So thank you so much for giving to our Patreon. That lets us, you know, not have day jobs. We can work in interviews whenever we want to, you know, whatever fits best for our guests. So thank you so much again for giving to the Patreon. Expect more cool interviews in the future. We got some stuff in the works, and we're going to try to get all of the Simpsons showrunners interviewed by us officially. We're coming for you, Al Jean.
So you can go back and listen to our interviews with Bill Oakley, which we refer to a couple times here, and our one with Mike Reese and with Mike Scully, if you want to hear those other showrunner ones too, just to check them off in your checklist if you're a new listener.
Yeah, the easiest way to do that is to just log on to the Patreon and then under post, click the little interview tab, and it'll just load up all the interviews in a nice little list. You can listen to all of them whenever you want. But yes, thanks again for giving to the Patreon, and please look forward to another great interview sometime soon. Later.
Bye.
Infotainment.